Thank you very much, Bill. That was fascinating. I think my doctor still uses two-minute cylinders, but just to time how long he's going to spend with me. And if you're not on an HMO, he uses his four-minute cylinder or something. You have to go out of the room with Michael Beale. Last night I told you I met Phil Carley, and it's just, he's another example of the wonderful kind of members we have and speakers we have here at ARSC. These people who wear many hats and bring all this experience and knowledge to their work and to share with us. Phil is as he describes it, a performing musicologist. He's just completed his dissertation, which is on orchestral and band music recorded before World War I. But when he's not here, he's on the road accompanying silent films on the piano. And I hope one day we can hear that too. You'll share that with us. We have a lot of friends in common, and I know that, and he's done some work for the library. It's been wonderful. So I'm going to introduce you to Phil Carley, who's going to talk about one of the people who Bill just mentioned, Van Molden, and I want to welcome you here. Thanks.
Well, thank you. And Bill is okay.
To move to the next slide, yep. Press that right arrow key.
Oh, okay. Let's see here. Just a second.
That's it.
Well, this is going to be kind of a mixed talk and a lot of listening as well, because I think many people have not heard U.S. Everlasting Cylinders in any great numbers, and also because the particular cylinders that I'm going to be talking about tie in with these very special diaries, which, again, I'll be talking about, and which delineate the whole process on a day-to-day basis of making records. My interest in Louis Vondermaiden was piqued by a find in Rochester about 5 years ago of a cache of 40 records made by U.S. Phonograph. What was interesting about them was that they were almost all orchestral and band, a few operatic cylinders. There were some of those U.S. Grand Opera series. But they were also of rather sophisticated literature, or what you wouldn't normally expect to see on cylinders. Things like the second movement of the Georg Goltermann Cello Concerto, or the Chardas from Coppelia, played by the U.S. military band. On playing these, the performances were extraordinary, and the fidelity was extraordinary. And on a couple of the lids was the name Louis Vondermaiden, which I had not run into before. Now, in this day and age, what is the first thing we all do when we want to find out about someone we haven't seen? We go to the internet. And much to my surprise, I found out that Louis Vondermaiden was the donor of the money for J. Louis Vondermaiden Recital Hall at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. It's named after him. It came through his widow. And his papers are there, including these diaries. We started, Sue Stinson and Robert Hodge, when I was doing the prep work for my dissertation for Eastman School of Music. I was at Syracuse University on a weekly basis. We did more delving, and we came up with this. And it's a picture of a man working in the studios and doing other things. But it's a very personal look. This is J. Louis Vondermaiden. He was born in San Francisco in 1873. His father and his uncle were both musicians. His father published a great deal of band music and dance music. In fact, if you go to the Library of Congress website, there's about 30 pieces attributed to the two Vondermaiden brothers. Louis took up the cello. He was also a pianist. And he went to the Leipzig Conservatory in 1894, from 1892 to 1894. He graduated from there with a diploma in piano composition and cello. He came back to the United States, went back to San Francisco, and evidently played alongside his father in theatrical orchestras and worked in bands as well. He somehow managed to get himself aligned with conducting band concerts in Presidio Park. In 1899, he married Susan Evelyn Bates. Susan was a school teacher. She'd graduated from the normal school, the Teachers College at Palo Alto. And the two of them were very, very well suited. They were unusually well educated and compatible. Susan was at least competent in French and German. She was a good pianist. She was also something of a financial whiz. She managed the family's finances throughout their married life together. And indeed, the two of them collaborated on a number of projects. Susan wrote verses which Lewis, whom I'll be referring to as Lewis throughout this talk, would set to music. And they tried to publish those as children's music. Also, Susan would help with the orchestration and copying out of parts of some of Lewis's compositions. In 1906, of course, there was the San Francisco earthquake and fire. And the Vondermaidens left the city after that. They lost everything. And at that point, it was decided they'd go to New York. They went to New York, and Lewis settled into a career as a cellist in various theatrical and concert orchestras. He played with the Aaron's People's Symphony Concerts, which was a low-priced series of symphony concerts in New York City. His stand partner was Lewis Heine, and the two of them became very good friends, and that name will crop up again in this. He also was playing and eventually became conductor at the Herald Square Theater in 1910. Now, after they moved to New York, the Vondermaidens started keeping a diary. Now, I say they kept a diary because it was a joint diary. It's a very charming, intimate look into their lives. It takes the form of letters from one to the other. Lewis's entries, when he puts them, are always addressed to "My dear Sue," and he talks about what he was doing that day. And Sue, when she takes a note, says various versions of, you know, "my darling sweetheart," "my loving sweetheart," "my extremely heroic sweetheart" on one occasion. And it's through Susan, on the 9th of November, 1910, we read, "My very busy sweetheart. This morning at 10, you played your first engagement in the phonograph, United States Phonograph Company. Then you came home at 12:45 and then matinee." At this time, Lewis was hired as an occasional cellist for the sessions by Albert Bensler, as near as we can figure. Now, there's not much that we can determine about Albert Bensler's background as a musician, but what there is indicates that he was, certainly by my estimation, a gifted, ambitious, and ultimately extremely frustrated musician. There are various accounts saying that he was classically trained in Germany. I'm not sure how or where. But when he came to Edison, he started working for the Edison Company in 1903 occasionally, and then became a staff member in 1904 through 1908 as a pianist and a mallet player on xylophone and bells. However, through Clarence Ferguson recalling to Jim Walsh in the 1950s, we found out that Bensler got increasingly frustrated at Edison. And it was partially because I don't think he got along with his colleagues particularly well. In fact, in terms of the selection for the music, which during the first part of the century was not by Thomas Edison, it was done at the 79 Fifth Street studio, he called the committee that was doing this the Jackass Committee. Now, he never names them, but the only people who were actually in charge of selecting music, at least by what records I've been able to determine, were Eugene Joudis, who was a violinist and conductor of most of the staff ensembles, Frederick Ecke, who was a German musician, a conductor and an operatic player at one point, and an arranger, who conducted most of the Edison concert band issues, and W.H.A. Cronkite, the universally hated studio manager of the National Phonograph Company studio. And Cronkite had been a professional cornetist in his youth. But Bensler really didn't care for the Edison staff. So when he went to U.S., he became the conductor of the house ensembles. It's the only notice that we have of Bensler actually being a conductor at all. In fact, until I found the Vondermeer diaries, because of this lack of evidence that he actually wielded a stick in any other capacity, I doubted that he did. But Vondermeer confirms this. Bensler's own background, the only reference we can find is that he was a theater musician. In fact, he was probably a pianist in a burlesque house. Under these circumstances, you wouldn't think that Bensler would be particularly anxious to collaborate with any musician coming into another studio, especially if he had been given his own control. But this was to prove very, this was going to be a very different case at US. What happened with Van der Maiden is that he makes notes every so often about his sessions. And it's often from Sue. And they get kind of a familiar tone to them. It becomes almost at least once or twice a week. One of the notes says here, this is February 7th, 1911. My sweetheart, you played in the funny graph. That's P-H-U-N-N-Y graph. And it broke at 3 p.m., and my sweetheart, today you wrote in the forenoon and played in the funny graph again from 1:30 to 4 p.m. He played also for the U.S. Grand Opera sessions, and he makes a note of having to play for Alan Hinckley again, which means that he'd played in sessions before. These sessions often were fairly marathon. The two sessions he notes for the 22nd and 23rd of February 1911 each ran over 6 hours. So, but one of these, we can give you an example of one of these, the U.S. Grand Opera cylinders, the early highbrow set. This is Alan Hinckley, the Calf of Gold aria from Faust, taken down a half step incidentally. As he was playing for the U.S. sessions, his professional life became increasingly unstable in the theater world. What happened was he got in the middle of a very bad labor dispute. He left the Herald Square Theater after a dispute with the manager over dismissing two players, which he didn't want to do. And he went over to the Winter Garden Theater within a day, and he took most of the orchestra from the Herald Square with him. Now, he was working for the Schuberts, who were notably cheap in running things. And at the Herald Square, he'd been there less than 2 months when in July, the Schubert management asked him to dismiss, well, it was a very large orchestra to begin with. It was a 52-man band at the Winter Garden, which is very different from Broadway circumstances today. He was asked to dismiss 22 members, all of whom had been promised a full season's work. When he brought that news to the orchestra said, well, you can dismiss us, but you still have to pay us. We've been promised the work. Lewis's response was to throw up his hands and leave everything. He left the Winter Garden, he resigned the Musicians' Union, and he ran away. His wife actually knew where he was. He went to visit friends in Connecticut, but she was very concerned about him. He was evidently very upset. And in a diary entry soon after this, she said, I don't know what to do for you. She wrote letters explaining the circumstances to many people, including John Kaiser at U.S. Phonograph. Some months later, though, he came back together, and he decided to do something else in that he became a full-fledged recording conductor. He made a proposal on the new year, 1912, to John Kaiser. He writes two letters, and he goes to visit and proposes, evidently, a series of special records. Now, we don't know what these special records are at first, but it becomes clear that it's for an orchestra session. And he begins to recruit a band, and this is very, very fast. This is between the 1st of January 1912, and on the 12th, Sue writes, "My noble sweetheart, we had a good sleep and rest last night and a fine breakfast. Then you went to the U.S. Phonograph Company, 662 6th Avenue, to make some records with your special orchestra." Lewis goes further. He mentions the three numbers that they recorded, the Isabella Overture by Suppé, Dance of the Hours by Ponchielli, and the Air on the G String by Bach, with a 24-man orchestra, a large orchestra for the period, and he gives the complete list of names for the orchestra. In this orchestra were people who have resonances for other points in this conference, one of whom is very impressive, is the percussionist. The timpanist is August Helmicke, who actually had got Lewis the job at U.S. Phonograph in the first place in 1910. August Helmicke was the bass drummer for the Sousa Band from 1915 to 1931 and the highest paid member in the Sousa Band. He was also a very inventive percussionist, and the U.S. records have a great deal of percussion in them. In the violins, the violin list lists Charles Dalmain in his last affiliation with any company on a steady basis, and Harold Sanford, who was concertmaster for the Victor Herbert Orchestra. What did the records sound like? Well, this is a fairly lengthy excerpt, but these, we have the first is the air by Bach, a little bit of it, and then we go on to a bit of the Isabella Overture by Suppé. Suppé. The records were very, very well received by the staff at New York. Kaiser took them to Cleveland, and they were passed. So there was a series of these made. The Von der Maiden Orchestra made, I think, 21 records over the next several months. And in addition, he was appointed to become the conductor for the special work. He became conductor for the special work, which meant that he was going to do the orchestral work. He did vocal work. That is, for the classical work. He also did special orchestrations, and he became a band conductor as well. In February, he made his first series of band records, which was with a band comprised largely of his players from the orchestra, bolstered with groups that with players that he knew professionally outside. Most of these he cornered at the Aschenbrödel Verein, which was a New York musical society and club where players kind of gathered. It was almost like a corral, a casting corral, as in Hollywood. But there was also a good deal of experimentation. I'm going to play a little bit of a very odd record, which was well, let's put it, on January 30th, during a session, he said that Mr. Labate made a test with Benzler on a piano, which came out very well. He's referring to Bruno Labate, who was the oboist in his orchestra and who was the founder of the American School of Oboe Playing. He was first oboist for over 3 decades with the New York Philharmonic. It's very odd to have an oboe solo at all. They made the test over the weekend. Von der Maiden made orchestrations of the Andante Pastorale from Benjamin Godard's Scènes Écossaises, and they recorded it with orchestra the next week on February 6th. It wasn't until the 13th of February that he actually got to hear the results of his first session. And one of the neat things is that he writes, his comment on them is, "They sound good. I will get them." They obviously weren't given to him as complimentary records. The other thing that's kind of interesting about the Von der Maiden recordings as a general rule is that when there's an introduction to a work, whether it's a waltz or a vocal selection, operatic solo, he always puts in the full introduction, which is often the most colorful section of the piece. This is the introduction to the waltz Violets by Emil Waldteufel. It's very interesting to hear how delicate the recording equipment was at the time. Listen for the cymbal crash, which is quite impressive. The slight swish you may hear may be the process, the result of the sealing process done with the ether, and it's common on many U.S. cylinders. I'll play a little bit further into this, into the waltz section as well. The band sessions started on February 15th, and that's when he started recording some of his own compositions. He wrote about 20 marches. His most popular ones were called Call of America and The Demon. The band he was very proud of. His entry for the band says, "I've given them a good band, and Kaiser thinks it's terrific." There's always, throughout the entries, a sense of enjoyment about working at US. He was paid $60 a week, which was not a bad salary at the time for a performing musician, plus the fact he was able to work in the evenings at the theaters. By this time, he was also playing in the pits of several Broadway theaters again. I'm going to play a little bit of The Demon, and then also beginning of Awakening of the Lion by Antoine Dukonsky. These are both played by the US concert band. The Awakening of the Lion is particularly important because it shows how sensitive the U.S. equipment was. It's taken from the very beginning, and it's August Helmicke doing percussion effects. Also, you'll hear a subterranean roar furnished by their special effects man, W.L. McCoy. So here's a bit of The Demon, and then followed immediately by Awakening of the Lion. By this time, von der Maiden became close friends with both Kaiser and Benzler. The diary entries note, for instance, they often go out to dinner together. He starts calling Benzler Benz. And John Kaiser comes up and visits them at their house in Connecticut. Generally, the way the week went was that Lewis worked in New York during the week, and they went up to Connecticut. But during the summer, when they broke for recording, I think because many of the musicians had engagements with bands and orchestras for the summer season, Kaiser comes up with Frank Banta, who was his nephew, and there's mentions who was later became, as many of you know, celebrated as a dance pianist and a famous recording pianist, the son of the Edison recording artist. There is an entry where it says, for a lark, everyone went down to a restaurant at the shore one evening. They were in Saybrook, Connecticut. And in Lewis's words, Frank had them all dancing with his fine piano playing. Frank Banta was 15 at the time. And by mid-1912, von der Maiden was enough of a figure within the U.S. that he was actually sent to a union meeting that was called by the New York Musical Protective Agency. November 4th, he was at the headquarters of the Musical Mutual Protective Union, and all the phonograph leaders were there, Ecca and Jean Joudis, Charlie Prince, and myself. The board wanted to know about phonograph conditions, so that was the reason of the summons. Now, the entry indicates a measure of familiarity with other figures in the phonograph industry. Fred Ecca and Eugene Joudis were the Edison conductors, and Charles Prince was at Columbia. There are two notable omissions, though. Walter Rogers, who was the conductor at Victor, but that's because most of the Victor orchestral recording was done at Camden, and their players would have come under the jurisdiction of the Philadelphia Union, I expect. The other notable exception is Albert Benzler, who, as the company's titular musical director, should have been there. I am conjecturing that he just didn't want to see Fred Ecca and Eugene Joudis. And Maiden, who was technically his junior, was just as good to go to the meeting. The last example I'd like to play is tied up with it's a visit by Lewis's wife, who comes on May 2nd. And she says, at 11:35, I went down to see you, and here you make a record of the Robin Hood selection, and you finally succeeded in getting a perfect one. Mr. Kaiser took me all through the different departments, and I saw the wax as it was received, and then put on the cylinders, and then on the copper plate. The most interesting thing was a view of the impressions of the sound vibrations. This is a most interesting field, and I'd like to be with you there. Little things like this crop up every so often. In fact, there's even a mention of a trial run with a disc machine at US, and the only mention we have of this is in the Von der Maiden Diaries. This is a little bit of the Robin Hood selection that Mrs. Von der Maiden was sitting in the studio for. Sorry about that. After the union meeting, though, things closed down pretty quickly, and it was very, very uncomfortable, very, very fast. There had been some notice of trouble with the company in that Kaiser, when he came up to visit the Von der Maidens in Old Saybrook, on August 1st, he'd said that Kaiser had told us about the phonograph company's business. He also had the printed notice of a meeting to be held next Tuesday by the board of directors, at which the stock will be bought by Mr. Garfield, Mr. Kirk D. Bishop remaining with the company. Things continued to record at a frantic pace. In fact, during early September, there are only entries, for instance, saying, all day at the phonograph. He doesn't even say what there is. But on November 19th, there's a huge heading in his diary which says, last day at the U.S. phonograph. My dear Sue, I received a letter from you today and also wrote you. This morning at 10 a.m. was band day at the phonograph. Haviland Medley No. 3 in Offa and Jessa March. Kaiser received a registered letter while the medley was going in, and after the march was over, told me to tell the men that the date was finished, and to tell the men also that, quote, this is Kaiser, on account of no wax, the dates for the rest of the week would have to be canceled. Later, Kaiser told me that it was all off. He was very much surprised. In fact, we all were. And a few days later, he got together with Benzler, and evidently Frank Hofbauer had blown the whistle or done something for them, because the note was, today Benz and I found out that Hofbauer has made quite a lot of mischief for us with the U.S. phono people. He undoubtedly did not know what he was saying, as the statements he is accused of having said are absolutely wrong. It's possible that he was got at by Edison people, and possibly even by Joseph McCoy, as it seems to be the practice. Von der Maiden went on from U.S., and he worked for another 5 years in the recording industry. And if you think 24 players is a large orchestra for an acoustic session that period, he went even bigger. By the time he was at the Lyraphone Company in 1917, he notes a 34-man orchestra. Good results could be had. And the diaries have not been examined at all. They're a fascinating look at the workings of a musician who not only made records because it was a job, but really enjoyed it. It comes through in the performances, in his relationships with the company, and in the experimentation that went on. For instance, there's the records always have percussion. You've heard timpani and cymbals and snare drum throughout. In his orchestra, he used tuba and string bass. There's a string bass player listed for it. So string bass did enter the acoustic studio. His career after this is beyond the scope of my presentation. If you went out of the music business, what did you do? Well, he got a law degree. He got a law degree and never practiced, and he also got a composition degree from Yale. He was an inveterate degree getter. So, but the biggest tribute to what he felt for his records.
I have a list of 100 records that they intended to release, but they never were, and they represented all those rejected molds from the fall of 1909. In 1910, they announced their product line in May. I believe that they weren't really selling records until that summer. I think in August 1910 is probably their first real issues to the public. Did that answer the question?
Well, I'm saying when they were recording, when we know the
earliest issue. I'm still not understanding the question, though.
The first issues of the U.S. Phonograph Company, when would they record? When was the big issue?
I would say probably in the winter, 1909-1910. They probably, by that time, had gotten rid of Isaac Norcross, and they sent Hofbauer and Hibbard up there to New York. So I think that they were recording that winter. They probably were building up their inventory and their repertoire, so by the summer, they were really sending records out. Yeah, Mike?
Did any of them ever have introduction announcements?
Mike asks, did any of them ever have introduction announcements? No, I've never heard one. What he's talking about is that wax cylinders typically told you the title, the artist, sometimes even the record number. But no, U.S. had stopped that because Edison ceased that practice in 1908. Approximately. Yes?
I'm curious how the cylinders came to light in Rochester, was it?
It's just one of those collecting finds that was very strange. It was in a junk shop. It was a box of cylinders that the gentleman had bought from an estate. But as I said, the unusual instance of it was the repertoire. And also, because the repertoire, as evidenced by the catalog listings and the number of things, was quite sophisticated. Even the Grand Opera issues, for instance, are very strange. There's a trio for three male voices from William Tell that was issued, which, interestingly, was recorded by the same three singers later for Columbia, about 5 months after it was done at U.S. So that was how they came about. I just happened to stumble across them. So,
Tim.
What exactly was the Bishop Babcock Becker Company doing? What were they doing?
Right. Tim asked, what was the Bishop Babcock Becker Company doing? Well, Bishop and Babcock was founded in 1886 to make hardware, plumbing supplies, beer pumps, and even nails and tacks. What really happened, I think, is that E.C. Beach, the first president of U.S. Phonograph, wasn't delivering. The shareholders were getting really upset because they'd been putting money into that company from 1908 until Christmas 1909. No results. By April 1910, Beach was out. Kirk D. Bishop was in as president. I think he fed money into the company and kept it going, and they made him president. And I think that's why it always says associated with Bishop Babcock Becker Company. And because the U.S. Phonograph plant wound up in one of the factory buildings on East 55th Street, that was a Bishop Babcock Becker faucet manufacturing plant. I think that's where all that casting and plating comes from that we see on the phonographs. Did that answer the question?
And who was this guy, Garfield, who's going to buy this stuff?
Remember I showed a picture of the Garfield building. So there was a businessman in downtown Cleveland. I don't know his background or name exactly, but I want to look into that. I think this Garfield guy is the next one who bailed out U.S. Phonograph.
And what was the date of that apocalyptic moment when they fired everybody?
It's November 19th, 1912, well, at least the studio. But they continued to release records well into 1913.
Yeah.
But they'd stockpiled so many masters. For instance, this announcement issue of the Air by Bach, okay, that was recorded in January at the very first session. They weren't issued. This was issued in April. And so they were parceling out releases, as far as I can tell. And with the amount of recording activity that was going on, and an evident market for the cylinders, they were stockpiling masters like crazy, particularly in the late spring and early fall.
And they never resuscitated the...
There's no further mention of that in the diaries, and Kaiser and Maiden remained friends for the rest of their lives. At least, there's no further reference to the studio in New York, and as a useful member, one who got along with people there, one would have expected him to be brought back.
Now, this is, that isn't where Tell Me Pretty Maiden came from, is it?
No, it's not where Tell Me Pretty Maiden came from.
You know, actually, they continued
to... It's a tough room.
They continued to record, and I think they let Fonder Maiden go because he was probably costly. $60 a week was five times the average annual, I mean, the average monthly salary.
What is it?
Average weekly salary was $11 in 1910, and they were paying him $60, and he wanted to have these 24-piece orchestras.
Except that there's no, when he gets together with Kaiser and Benzler, there's no further reference to them recording at 6th Avenue.
Okay.
There's no further reference to that studio being used. So I'm not sure that they actually did continue to record at that location or that they recorded at all. So.
Okay. One more?
Yeah,
one Mike?
How well did these things sell?
How well did they sell? Well, I own 2,000 of them, U.S. cylinders. It was a very small operation. They were making 5,000 a month. Their capacity was 5,000 a month. At the time, Edison was making a quarter million a month.
So how many months were they in business?
They were in business for 4 years, essentially, 1910 into 1914.
You've got good percentage of their
Bill, and he doesn't look his age at all. I want to thank you. I want to cut off just for Louise because we have a session at 10:30. This gives you a little time for a break. But I want to thank both of you. It's just fantastic.